then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more door for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man day chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's Thanksgiving Day, November the 25th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, for reasons having to do with the fact that it's Thanksgiving, and also some loss of computer time due to power failures a few days ago, plus the urgent need to at least sit down and take a look at the novel number 5 manuscript sometime this week, etc., etc., I am really, really rushed. I don't have time to script this, and so I'm just going to have to sit here and babble for a couple hours and hope to God that I can use my wave pad to edit the gabble into some kind of presentable hour's worth of program. First off, I want to thank all of our comrades in the state of Oregon who came to our Northwest Front get-together in Salem over this last weekend. I was meeting many of you for the first time, and I have to say that I'm highly impressed with the kind of local talent that the Northwest Front is beginning to attract. Like I've said before, folks, progress is being made. It's slow, but it's there. Now, mea culpa, mea culpa. I was a real naughty boy in last week's podcast. I flubbed a few things, and it appears I've got all kinds of stuff to correct and apologize for in this week's show. First and foremost, apparently the alleged Richard Wagner piece I played entitled The Hall of the Mountain King is actually by the Norwegian composer Edvard Grieg instead. Now, guys, I know this is going to sound like I'm making excuses, but I swear on a stack of Mein Kampf that this one isn't entirely my fault. Last week I was looking around for a fairly short Wagner piece to play, since, like I said, most of the classical cuts are simply too long for this show, and I found The Hall of the Mountain King on YouTube, where it was clearly labeled as being by Wagner. I liked it. I'd heard it before in the past, although I did say to myself, I didn't know that was Wagner. But since classical music isn't my area of expertise, I didn't think anything of it. I figured whoever uploaded it to YouTube knew what the hell he was talking about. So then I found the song, and I bought it, and I downloaded it from Amazon.com, where it was once again labeled as being by Richard Wagner. So apparently the people at Amazon are just as ignorant about classical music as I am. Nonetheless, I should have double-checked it and made sure that I was right on the attribution, so this one is still my bad. Anyway, that's about the only decent classical piece I've found so far that's short enough to fit into this format for music breaks on Radio Free Northwest, but if I find anything else like that, I'll make absolutely certain to check its provenance. Now, regarding Professor Kevin MacDonald, first off, yes, I misspelled his name on the Homeland blog. It's M-A-C and not M-C. That error was pointed out to me, and it's been corrected, and I'd like to thank those of you who did point that out. Secondly, again on the subject of Professor MacDonald, it appears that I was also wrong last week about his affiliation with something called the Occidental Descent blog. Professor MacDonald's website and publication is the Occidental Observer. Occidental Online Quarterly is the website of the Occidental Quarterly Journal, which is run by Georgia attorney Sam Dixon. And Occidental Descent is a blog where a bunch of racist intellectuals write long, erudite posts to each other, showing one another how clever and witty and brilliant they are, and which nobody else reads. As you may have gathered, Occidental is a word that intellectual racists use when they're afraid to say white. Now, that's why you get Occidental this and Occidental that and references to Occidental civilization instead of white civilization, so forth and so on. The intellectual racists go for this whole idea that a revolution can somehow be a tea party, no pun intended, and that if we're all just polite and nice and we never say nigger and never even identify ourselves as white, then our enemies will be nice and polite about it all as well. I think we all know how that's working out. Anyway, Occidental Dissent, where the pseudos were trashing the Northwest Migration a few weeks ago, is in fact run by somebody using the name Hunter Wallace, who claims to live in Montgomery, Alabama. I say claims because always remember the first rule of the internet. You never know who you are talking to, and you never know who is on the other end of that computer. In many cases, what people post on the internet can be very deceptive unless you know for certain who these people are and what kind of agenda they're acting on or whose. If I can wander a bit, as I so often do, I might notice en passant that a lot of the people on the V-Bulletin boards and the intellectual racist blogs and elsewhere who are so loud and aggressive and in your face on the internet about denouncing the Northwest migration and bellowing out how it will never work and Harold is an idiot and a Jew and a Fed and all that crap, these same people generally rubbish and poo-poo it all anytime anybody comes up with any idea that might actually have a chance of changing things. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to lash out and accusing anyone who disagrees with me of being one of Cass Sunstein's cognitive dissonance operatives. I wouldn't do that regardless of any personal suspicions I might hold because it's almost impossible to prove. It's the old question of whether someone is behaving in a certain negative and assholic way because they're an enemy agent or because they're simply an asshole. And how many times have most of us asked ourselves that? It's usually almost impossible to tell. But what you have to understand is that in the white movement, as with all other subcultures, there is a very definite status quo. And as in all other aspects of life, there are people who benefit from the continuation of that status quo. In our case, pseudo-intellectual racists and fearless leader types who benefit from the status quo financially, but more importantly in the form of ego gratification from being middling big fish in a very small pond. Puddle more like. But still, some of these would-be intellectual types are the biggest tadpoles in the puddle. Like all status quos, our tiny little movement's status quo depends for its continued existence on no one rocking the boat. And the Northwest Imperative definitely rocks the boat of our status quo. This is why we are often shocked to find out that the most bitter and angry and vicious attacks against the Northwest come from people who claim to believe as we do. Or at least their internet personalities claim to believe as we do. Remember, usually we have no idea who these people actually are, where they are, or what agenda they're operating on. Almost all of these constant, nattering nabobs of net negativism, as Spiro Agnew would have said, use untraceable pseudonyms and email handles. And sometimes they go so far as to post through proxy servers, so no one can trace their general geographic location through their IP address. Whenever you might be tempted to start taking some of these knights who say V-Bulletin seriously and letting them get to you and get you feeling all depressed about the Northwest, it'll never work, the hill is too steep, so forth and so on, just remember, nobody knows who they really are, and so nobody can vet them and check their bona fides and determine just what is the basis in their own experience and their own track record for their claim to have the moral authority to be able to tell everybody else what to do and, more importantly, tell them what not to do. No one really knows who most of these internet naysayers are, where they've been, what they've done, and who's signing their checks. And when we do know who they are, what we know isn't very edifying, Glenn Miller being a case in point. I mean, with me, everybody knows where I've been and what I've been doing with my life for the past 40 years. In fact, on November the 19th, I sent out to some of you an old photograph of me taken in Raleigh at a press conference 30 years ago to the day, swastika and all. So like I said, I have a traceable internet footprint, and whether or not you agree with the whole Northwest migration thing, at least there's no doubt as to the basic question of who I am. Now, that doesn't apply to a lot of these names you see on the internet attacking the Northwest and telling us all how no, it'll never work. So when you see all this anti-Northwest drivel on the net, the first question you need to ask yourself is about the individuals who are posting it and their motivations. Who exactly is this person who is bashing the Northwest Republic? Now, 9 times out of 10, he'll be using some common-sounding name that no one ever heard of. You won't be able to trace him on the net beyond a few posts and blogs of the same kind, and he won't answer direct questions about his real identity or his whereabouts, or basically who the hell he is. Now ask yourselves, why are they bad-mouthing me of the Northwest? In whose interest is this activity? In other words, who benefits from having the Northwest run down and from having anyone who might decide to get involved with the Northwest imperative demoralized and depressed? Anyway, I again apologize for even so much as suggesting last week that Professor Kevin MacDonald has anything to do with this website. He does not. Professor MacDonald's site is called Occidental Observer. In point of fact, and in view of our now around 4,000 listeners per week to Radio Free Northwest, I most likely was the one who gave these people a boost by mentioning them at all. Boy, I walked into that one, didn't I? So, why did I do so? I did it because it's part of my job publicly to defend the Northwest Imperative and the Northwest American Republic against all attacks, even those that come from people on our own side who are misguided or badly motivated. And by the way, just to be clear, that may well be all that's happening with these Occidental descent people. I'm not saying that there's some kind of false flag or cognitive dissonance operation. Now, that's the trouble with these things. You can almost never prove your suspicions, unless something happens like it did with the Hal Turner case and the guy in question gets jammed up and his own FBI handlers or whoever end up getting dragged into court and forced to testify in public that this character was working for him. Now, before people start sending me nasty emails about how the NF uses false names and email IDs for our people as well, about how I advocate covert cellular organization and how we don't shout out our own real names on the internet either except for myself. Yeah, you're right, we don't. So, let's recap. There is nothing wrong with trying to conceal your identity from the enemy if you have a job and a family to protect. And I'm not saying that. But if you are going to stand up on the internet or anywhere else and pretend to be a spokesman for the white resistance movement and put forth your own ideas, your own writing, and your own work as some kind of point for discussion or whatever you want to call it, the fact is that the people you're addressing have the right to know who you are and where you're coming from. If you hope to accomplish anything and build a movement, that's small m, you have to learn to balance security consciousness with effectiveness. And sooner or later, in order to be effective, somebody has to stand up and speak. Your own people have to trust that you're on the level. And for that to happen, your own people need to have at least some idea as to who the hell they're talking to and who the hell is standing up in public and speaking allegedly for them. What is this person's track record? Why should they listen to you with any respect or attention? Now, right now, I'm the only one doing that for the Northwest Front. I'm sometimes asked why I didn't publish my Northwest novels under a pseudonym like William Pierce did with the Turner Diaries and Hunter. Well, one big reason is that I've always known that if I want my ideas and my principles to be taken seriously, I have to stand up in public to defend them. And I can't do that while hiding behind a false name. Now, it's true that for a couple of years back in the 90s, I used the pen name of Winston Smith, but that was a joke based on the novel 1984. And I dropped it when it became obvious that a lot of people didn't get the humor and it was actually causing me problems. My use of a pen name actually drove certain people within the movement around the twist. I mean, raging, frothing, foaming at the mouth, epileptic seizure type material. I've never understood why. It was supposed to drive the left nuts, but instead it seems to have driven the goat dancers into a real frenzy, and I think I've babbled enough for the moment, and I better get on to the first music break. Some weeks ago, I promised you guys a 1960s folk music theme for the show, but we got sidetracked into something and I didn't get around to it. Now, I was rooting around on YouTube and through my own memory, and on sober reflection, I have to admit that most of that 1960s folk music craze wasn't really all that good, music-wise. I guess it was one of those things where you kind of had to be there to get it. Peter, Paul, and Mary and Pete Seeger, for example, were some fine musicians, but their politics were so utterly red that I'm not going to play anything they did on here. But there were some good groups and singers in those days who weren't total screaming Reds and Liberals. This is a French-Canadian song by a couple of Canadian folk singers from the 1960s, Ian and Sylvia. La la bon bam, la la jolly bon, la la bon 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 mi ma pelle, la la bon bam, la la jolly bon, la la bon 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 mi ma ton. Derrière chez nous y a ton étang, derrière chez nous y a ton étang, trouble canard son bon bayon, la la bon bam, la la jolly bon, la la bon 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 mi ma pelle, la la bon bam, la la jolly bon, la la bon 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 mi ma ton.
Le fils de va s'en va chassant et avec son grand fusil d'argent. La 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 la. Vis à les noix, tout va les blancs, vis à les noix, tout va les blancs, et tous ces brins s'en vont au vent. Balaloumba, 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 mamie me pèle, balaloumba, 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 mamie me tombe. Ils sont pas dans les reins de sang, ils nous feront un lit de camp. Balaloumba, 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 mamie me pèle, balaloumba, 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 mamie me tombe. Nous coucherons.
Now, what I want to do right now is repeat something that I told you guys by email earlier this week, and that is that the new NVA attack video, if you want to call it that, which has been done by Colonel House, needs to go viral if it is to have its intended effect, and that's nowhere near happening yet. I just checked the main site, and it's gotten only about 1,200 hits in 6 days. Although, to be sure, there are already a couple of mirror sites, which I'm sure are racking up some hits as well. Now, guys, I'm dead serious. I want this to be the first white nationalist video ever to break 1 million hits on YouTube. Maybe that won't happen on the original site, since the YouTube authorities will probably pull it at some point or another, once the Jews catch on to it and they complain. But I want to get a total of 1 million hits on this one video, so that's 1 million people who will know where our post office box is and where our website is, and of those, thousands will at least make the effort to come to that website and see what the Northwest Front has to say. Now, one of the things I'm doing is promoting this video on Facebook. If you have a Facebook account, go ahead and use that in any way you can. You guys need to get really creative out there as far as finding new ways to get this internet address in front of especially young white people and trying to persuade them to go to the site. Now, I've explained the reasoning behind this video and the purpose it's intended to serve in a couple of separate emails and also in a separate audio letter. I don't want to go over all of that again right now because we have to assume that the enemy is indeed listening. But suffice it to say that this is the first thing that the Northwest Front has done with the specific intention of trying to get noticed by the establishment. Now, if you want to call it a publicity stunt, that's fine with me. At least a publicity stunt like this is better than our standing on a street corner wearing some kind of strange costumes and holding signs and making jackasses out of ourselves. Now, most of you seem to understand what I'm talking about. Most of you seem to have gotten the idea, although the low number of hits indicates that not enough of you are pushing the video on the net. Well, okay, I understand. This is the week of Thanksgiving, and a lot of our people have holiday and family-related stuff to do. But I do hope that, if nothing else after the holiday, you guys will really start pushing this video all over the net and trying to drum up as many hits as you can for it. You might say this is going to be our primary piece of audiovisual propaganda for a while. Now, on the downside, we do have a few people who have panicked and broken and fled screaming into the night because, oh, this video is violent. It advocates violence. It's going to get us in trouble, Harold. You're crazy, Harold. You're going to get us all in trouble, Harold. Well, apparently, these guys think that the FBI agents hiding under their bed will creep out and arrest them for watching a video on YouTube. Or something. Hell, I have no idea what goes on in the minds of people who are that timid and frightened. I've already told you guys not to worry. Nobody is going to arrest you simply for watching a video. If anybody gets visited by the FBI or Homeland Security, whoever, it'll be me or House. Now, for those of you who have not seen our new video, you need to check out the Thought Crime blog for Sunday, November the 21st. And the URL for the video is on there, and the URL for Thought Crime is http blah 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 down with jug ears, that's all one word, down with jug ears.blogspot.com. downwithjugears.blogspot.com. Go to that blog and check out the post for Sunday, November 21st, and you'll find the internet address for our new NVA attack video. Bookmark it, make a note of that URL, and spread it around. We need to get some hits on this, guys. We need to get a million hits on this. Dead serious. Now, on to something else. Now, remember a few weeks ago when I talked about how I could sometimes tell when we have somebody who's about to flake on us? Well, we have a lady out there whom I won't name or identify as to her location because it is not in any way, shape, or form my intention to embarrass her or hector her or insult her or ridicule her or anything like that. But although to some degree I am talking about her, I'm also talking about a situation, and that's one that's occurred in the past and which will unquestionably occur again. Now, this lady has been promising and swearing that she's going to come home ever since she first got into contact with a party about a year ago. And she even set a date of December of this year for her scouting trip here to Washington, which is not the month I'd choose to come here to the Northwest. But anyway, that's what she's been promising. And now she's reached the point where it's time to actually get in the car and start rolling in a northwesterly direction. And she's pretty clearly starting to get the Jim Jams. I can tell because all of a sudden these little doubts and niggling questions that I've already answered before on numerous occasions and which should have vanished from her thinking many months ago are starting to pop up again in her emails. And I can read the vibes. Long experience tell me that if she's not about to bolt, she's considering it. My guess is that at the last minute, something will come up or there will be no scouting trip. And she'll either find some sound and logical and convincing reason why she just has to stay where she is for another year or so, or more likely, she'll simply disappear. The internet lets you do that. That's why we need to be living within half an hour's drive of one another, so that when somebody drops out of sight, a unit leader or someone from our own community can go over and pound on the door and find out what's wrong. I think that may be one reason why so many ostensible white nationalist people avoid living in communities. I think a lot of us want to be able to disappear if it ever gets too real or too scary or the pressure actually to do something involving risk or inconvenience gets too strong. We want to have that option of irresponsibility. We don't want to get so far into some kind of racial movement that we can't cut and run and disappear when we want to. That's us. That's 21st century white Americans. I don't know why this lady is getting jumpy. I just sense that she is. She mentioned that she was frightened by the new video. Well, that is going to happen. You know, we really are serious about all this, and we're not breaking any laws right at the moment, and we have no intention of breaking any laws anytime soon. But I'm not going to deny who we are and what we advocate. And I'm not going to stop, making observations on the human condition, which indicate things that may happen in the future, if you'll pardon the circumlocution. In other words, basically, I'm not going to lie to people. This is the real thing, and eventually it's going to get real here in the Northwest. Look, guys, I understand. I've been there myself. Ma'am, if I could address you directly, would it surprise you to know that I, myself, had a panic attack of my own just before I came home? That was in May of 2002. I was living in College Station, Texas, the home of Texas A&M. I had just handed in my notice at the best job I've ever had in my life. And even as I did so, I heard this nagging little voice in the back of my mind saying, "Jesus, Harold, are you nuts? What the hell are you doing giving up all this money?" And over the next few days, I started having these sinister little thoughts popping into my head, these little whispers of doubt and maybe and what about this and what about that? Harold, you really could stand to save up some more money before you make this move. You could withdraw your notice and wait until October and work through the summer and save some more money like that. In other words, I found myself looking for excuses not to go, even though I had already started the move by shipping a lot of my stuff up here to Washington and having it stored here. Now, I didn't give in to the nagging little voices, but my main point is that I know you're hearing them right now, ma'am, and all of you guys, when you get ready to make your move, even when it gets to the point where the U-Haul is packed and you've quit your jobs and turned off your utilities and everything is ready to go, there's always going to be that nagging little voice in the back of your mind saying, no, no, you can't do this. This is too dangerous. It's crazy. It's risky. You might get in trouble. Stick with what you know. Kind of the reverse of that old pioneer spirit our people used to have. In the old days, our forefathers got the urge, the voices in their mind, telling them to pack that wagon and move west. These days, we get the little voices telling us to stay where we are and hunker down and hope to God that the trouble passes us over. It's part of the dark side of our nature in the 21st century. It's a dark side that we've been socially engineered by the Jews to have and to live with, but we have to overcome it. You can tell I'm ad-libbing here, I'm just babbling, but ma'am, I know what you're going through, and I think you know in your heart what's right, and I have every confidence that you'll do what's right. I'm looking forward to seeing you soon. Okay, moving right along here. I've just learned that there's another individual coming into town over the Thanksgiving weekend who I'm going to have to meet with, which it's about time since he's been on the list for about 3 years, and we do need to get together. But that's going to cut even further into the time I have allocated to try and finish part one of the 5th Northwest Independence novel. In view of the fact that I'm going to have to do another Radio Free Northwest next week, as well as the December issue of Northwest Observer, I am no longer certain that I'll be able to meet my commitment to get part one of the book on the Battle of Portland out to the Review and Proofreading Committee by the end of the month. Now, I know I've bitched and moaned about this situation before, about having no assistant, but it is what it is, and I suppose I need to quit bitching and moaning about it and accept it as a fact of life. I'll do my best, but at this point, in the absence of anyone else willing to make a lifetime commitment to the Northwest Republic, I can't make any guarantees on schedules or deadlines or, frankly, on the quality of the work. Now, this gets into something else, which I want to talk to you about very briefly, just to let you know what's going on. Because of these three main projects that I have to do, the Observer, Radio Free Northwest, and the 5th Northwest Independence novel, plus at least a certain bare minimum of email and organizing and personal correspondence, so forth and so on. From this point on, for at least the next year, my time is going to have to be budgeted practically on a minute-by-minute and day-by-day basis. And I am simply not going to have the time to do even some of the things that I've been doing for the past 18 months or so. Now, what I'm getting at here is that until such time at least that the 5th book is finished, any progress that the Northwest Front makes as such, by way of organization, by way of building members, by way of meetings, almost all of this is going to have to come from local organizers and people on the ground here in the Northwest. I have finally sort of hit a wall or a plateau here, whatever you want to call it, where I, at least for the next year or so, am simply not going to be able to do much more than what I have assigned myself to do. Any extras are going to have to come from local people on the ground. Now, for this purpose, we're going to have to finally start forming proper local units here in the Northwest homeland. And that's what I want to talk about in the next segment. Right now, second music break. In my Aryan History series, there was an article called The Fate of Franklin, and that had to do with the expedition of Sir John Franklin in 1845 in an attempt to find the Northwest Passage around the pole so that they could basically sail ships through from Europe on right directly to the Orient without having to sail all around the tip of South America. Eventually, that problem was solved, of course, by the building of the Panama Canal, but in the days before the canal, this made a good deal of sense to try and find this mythical Northwest Passage. Actually, it is possible to do that. There is sort of a Northwest Passage, but it's just so complicated and it's so variable due to the ice pack and everything like that that it can never be really made commercially viable. Another little interesting historical tidbit is the first ship ever to navigate the Northwest Passage successfully was a ship called the Octavius. It sailed through from Hudson Bay on out to the Pacific Ocean, or rather drifted through on the ice after a period of about 8 years, something like that. And it had a crew full of dead men. They had some kind of plague that broke out on board, and the crew all died, and the ship just basically drifted through the ice all through the Northwest Passage. Anyway, enough of that. This is one of those groups that I mentioned from the 1960s that actually were pretty good musicians and pretty good folk singers, a British group called Pentangle.
just homeward bound one night on the dune. Swinging in my hammock, I fell asleep. I dreamed a dream and I thought it true. Concerning Franklin and his gallant crew. With 100 seamen he sailed away to the frozen ocean in the month of May, to seek a passage around the pole. We poor seamen do sometimes go. Through cruel hardships they mainly stroll, their ships on mountains of ice was grown. Only the Eskimo in his skin canoe, the only one that ever came through. Baffin Bay, where the whale fishes blow, the fate of Franklin no man may know. The fate of Franklin no tongue can tell. Lord Franklin alone, with his sailors doing well. Now my bird gives me pain. My long lost Franklin, I will cross the main. 10,000 pounds would I freely give to say on earth that my Franklin.
All right, I was going to talk about local organizing again because, as I just mentioned, my own time is pretty much spoken for over the next year or so, and any progress on the ground for the Northwest Front as a movement is going to have to come from you guys out there who are actually living in the homeland and who are willing to get out there and start bringing in other people to this cause and turning them on to a sense of their own racial destiny. Most of us seem content to sit around waiting for Harold Covington to pull a rabbit out of his hat. Okay, I'm working on the rabbit, the last one I'll ever produce. But in the meantime, I'm going to need some action from you guys to try and grow this thing. Most of all this, I've ranted before down through the years, and I'll try to get out of the problem-stating phase as fast as I can. We do entirely too much stating and restating the problem to the exclusion of everything else. Now, the classic definition of stupidity is doing the same thing over and over again and yet expecting a different result every time. Now, I've just stated in a nutshell the entire history of the American white nationalist movement. Guys, you're going to have to find a way to break this pattern, and my available time to walk you through it is going to be kind of limited from now on. Essentially, what the white man has been doing for the past 50 years in our pathetic efforts to resist racial and cultural extinction at the hand of the Jews is that we've taken this attitude of, if you build it, they will come. Well, we build it every 4 or 5 years, or at least an approximation of it, and they never come. It hasn't worked. Nothing we have tried has worked. I won't go quite so far as to say that everything we've done since 1945 has been a total waste. It hasn't been, not quite. There are some lessons to be learned, if only negative ones. We've spent the past 60 years demonstrating how not to do it. Now, what do I mean by that? The first thing we need to do is to ditch this Rotary Club approach towards political organizing for white people, this 1930s Germany approach. Anything that requires any kind of mass movement or mass response. Ain't happening. No way, Jose. White people are no longer capable of responding in the way we want them to respond to all of the standard Rotary Club-style tactics and democracy-based strategies that we've been using. Now, the problem is not what we've been doing. The problem is who we are. Since we don't have the option of giving up, we have to find a way somehow to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, to use what we've got, to take highly inferior human material and create a genuine national independence movement here in the Pacific Northwest. We have to do this because it is the last chance that white people will ever have to survive on this North American continent. Okay. These are our starting points. First, the present system is absolutely corrupt and utterly beyond redemption. The Northwest Front has to ditch anything to do with democracy or electoral politics or which requires a lot of white people getting together and doing something. They won't do it. We've lost the necessary instincts and abilities. White people have been socially engineered by the Jews into complete narcissism. Only a complete and total change in the entire order of society from the ground up can suffice to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Now, the short word for this is revolution. We have to seek total change, not any kind of reform. There is no point in participating in elections in a two-party system where all the candidates have their lips firmly pressed to the Jews' buttocks. There is no point in attempting to gain entrance into the power structure of our racial enemy. We simply will not be allowed in, period, end of story, and will be destroyed or rendered neuter if we persist in the attempt to work within the system. Now, the Ron Paul experience in the 2008 election demonstrates the futility of this. Dr. Paul did a lot better than any white nationalist group can ever expect to do. He had a large, enthusiastic following, both on the internet and in the real world. He raised almost $20 million in donations, and so he had the resources to compete with the establishment's candidates. Now, there is no way in hell that either the Northwest Front or any other white nationalist group will ever see $20 million in legally raised funds. Ron Paul had an intelligent and workable program, and he was personally charismatic. He was a good speaker, so forth and so on. In short, though Paul was not by any stretch of the imagination one of us, he had all the things that we claim were waiting to fall out of the sky for us. Oh, if only we could get some money, if only we could, yada, yada, yada. I'm sure most of you heard this refrain at one time or another, so you can fill in the blanks. And Ron Paul was royally screwed for his trouble. The establishment media treated him like a crank. They laughed at him and derided him and excluded him from most of the presidential primary debates. They spread stupid smears and slanders about him, including a bogus connection with us in the form of an alleged donation of $500 from Don Black. And when it came time to vote, they simply stole all his votes in New Hampshire and banned him from the rest of the debates. And that was that. Ron Paul was a genuine outsider, and outsiders in this society are never allowed to get anywhere near the levers of power, period, end of story. Now, if a U.S. congressman is treated like that, how in God's name is a white separatist movement in the Northwest ever going to get a fair shake? The power structure and the people who control it will not listen to us. Why should they? They've been ignoring us for generations, and they've suffered no adverse consequences from that. So why should they not continue to ignore us and do whatever the hell they want for their own benefit and for the Jews who pay them? It's the system itself that threatens our racial and cultural existence, and it's the system itself that has to go. The system does not need to be reformed. It needs to be destroyed and replaced with something designed specifically to serve the racial interests of white people. Now, the second thing that NF local organizers have to bear in mind at all times is that change cannot be accomplished solely through quote-unquote education. We need to quit using education as an excuse to evade our racial duty. It's true that we have to change the white man's collective thinking. We have to change his knowledge of the nature of the world around him and his perception of people and events, and that requires propaganda, which isn't quite the same thing as education. But there will come a time when the propaganda has to cease and the action begin. Now, that's the moment that we need to recruit and prepare our people for. Never forget, America has an expiration date on it. Education is a means to an end. Now, we've been using quote-unquote education as one more fig leaf to cover our moral nudity, to avoid incurring personal risk and doing the heavy lifting that we all know has to be done by somebody. We need to have local units ready and waiting for racial settlers once they arrive here. Now, thirdly, we have to get out of our heads that there is any nice way to do this. When real men want to change something, they change it. They don't worry about whether anyone will let them change things. Real men don't ask anyone's permission. They just do it. They don't ask permission of the people whose self-interest will be affected. Of course, those who currently hold wealth and power and position in this putrid society will never voluntarily surrender it. No one ever does. These people have devoted their lives and their careers to doing harm to you and yours. Their desires or opinions in the matter should be disregarded. The people who hold power and wealth in this society use it solely for themselves, to feed their own gargantuan, perverted appetites and egos. They are bad people. They have no rights and deserve no consideration at your hands. Why would you allow someone to do you harm on the grounds that they have quote-unquote rights? That's just silly. It's a rule that bad people made up to protect themselves from being punished for their behavior. The only point at which these people should come into the matter is when we decide what is to be done with them after we have made the necessary changes and taken power out of their hands and into our own. We cannot do this by calling a radio talk show host and bitching, or by tapping on a computer keyboard, or by going into a silly little booth and pulling an electronic lever to cast a vote that the Diebold Corporation may or may not decide to count. Now, if we want change, we have to change things, if you get my drift, and I'm sure you do. Fourth, we need to rethink our relationship with the internet when it comes to local organizing. Now, local units will need their own website, sure, but we can't be just nothing but net. A local unit has to consist of real people who do real things in the real world. Now, the internet is a means and not an end. It's a means of communication only, like a telephone or a radio or the postal service. It is not and cannot be a substitute for real-world human activism by human beings. The reason that we tend to plunge into the internet like we do and live there once we get there is simple. Once again, it gets back to our character. And what happens on the net stays on the net. The internet is sterile. It produces nothing but more internet. Real-world results have been almost nil, and since we got onto the internet, real-world physical activity in the movement has almost ceased. That has to be reversed. The Northwest Front needs to be the first group to take our whole movement, our whole concept of white nationalism off the internet and back into the real world. Now, one of the hardest things we're going to have to accept is that we must now begin to lay the kind of foundation-building groundwork that should have been begun two generations ago, and which should have been completed in the last generation. The white nationalist movement in America has no infrastructure of any kind remaining. We're going to have to build whatever we need from the ground up here in the Northwest. We're going to end up working on projects and doing things that should have been done in the 1960s, but which never were done because, okay, I won't go into all that again. Now, finally, local organizers for the Northwest Front must always bear in mind just how badly dysfunctional and damaged white people are, how shallow and short-sighted their political thinking is, how seriously impaired white people's ability to understand the consequences of their actions has become, and how urgently white people are possessed by the American instilled desire for instant gratification. Now, we are dealing out there with very largely a group of adolescents who never completely grew up, who have no concept at all of personal responsibility for their behavior, and they become extremely neurotic and unstable through trying to survive and exist in a profoundly unnatural world. It's going to be necessary for the Northwest Front to at least remove the taboo on the discussion of direct action to bring about social and political change. We will never be able to implement a solution when the time is right if we tremble in terror even to discuss the only possible thing we can do in order to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, especially in these times when the FBI arrests people for posting poems to the internet and government employees grope people in airports. Basically, guys, it's a mess out there, and for the next year, I'm simply not going to be as available to help you as I should be. But I still need you, all of you who live here in the homeland, to step forward and begin the process of bringing the white people of the Northwest around to understanding and accepting their destiny, which is to become the newest, sovereign, and independent nation on the face of the earth. Okay, enough of this rambling. More 60s folk music. This is the Kingston Trio.
Down on yonder knee, he's sneaking round and creeping, and his eye watching me. He's pulling and he's teasing, but his meaning's not so bad. If it's ever going to be, tell me now, Johnny lad. Tell me now, my Johnny laddie. Tell me now, my Johnny lad. If it's ever going to be, tell me now, Johnny lad. When the sheep are in the fold and the cows are in the byre, and other lads and lasses sitting round a roaring fire, there's me, a silly lassie, just as like as if I's mad, through the nooks and barley stooks, teasing you, Johnny lad. Teasing you, my Johnny laddie. Teasing you, my Johnny lad. Through the nooks and barley stooks, teasing you, Johnny lad. Oh, Johnny's blithe and bonny, he's the pride of yonder lee, and I love him best of any, though he's aye teasing me. Though he teases me and squeezes me and tickles me like mad, none comes near me that can cheer me like my own Johnny lad. Aye, it's you, my Johnny laddie. Aye, it's you, my Johnny lad. None comes near me that can cheer me like my own Johnny lad. Oh, my Johnny's not a gentleman, nor yet is he a laird, but I would follow Johnny, although he was a caird. Oh, Johnny is a bonny lad, he was once a lad of mine, and I've never had a better lad, though I've had 29. And with you, my Johnny laddie, and with you, my Johnny lad, oh, I'll dance the buckles off my shoes with you, Johnny lad. And with you, my Johnny laddie, and with you, my Johnny lad, oh, I'll dance the buckles off my shoes with you, Johnny lad.
Well, since Thanksgiving is this week, I suppose I should have something holiday related on here. So what I think I'll do is I will actually read out to you here from my Weird Aryan History series the genuine, real live first Thanksgiving proclamation. Now, I know we've all grown up on the official version of Thanksgiving, which is that the Pilgrims, after their first year at Plymouth Rock, which would have placed it in 1621, had a big feast to celebrate their survival in the New World, and they invited all their Indian friends. And it was also lovely and diverse, and the white people and the Indians all sat down at big long picnic tables with roasted turkeys and cranberry sauce and pumpkin pie. Anyway, this is the actual beginning of Thanksgiving. It's a proclamation issued by the governor of the colony of Massachusetts on June the 20th, 1676. That's 56 years after the Pilgrims landed. The holy God, having by a long and continual series of his afflictive dispensations in and by the present war with the heathen natives of this land, written and brought to pass bitter things against his own covenant people in this wilderness, yet so that we evidently discern that in the midst of his judgments he hath remembered mercy, having remembered his footstool in the days of his sore displeasure against us for our sins, with many singular intimations of his fatherly compassion and regard, reserving many of our towns from desolation threatened and attempted by the enemy, and giving us especially of late with our many confederates many signal advantages against them, without such disadvantage to ourselves as formerly we have been sensible of. If it be the Lord's mercy that we are not consumed, it certainly bespeaks our positive thankfulness, when our enemies are in any measure disappointed or destroyed, and fearing the Lord should take notice under so many intimations of his returning mercy, we should be found an insensible people, as not standing before him with thanksgiving, as well as lading him with our complaints in the time of pressing afflictions. The council has thought meet to appoint and set apart the 29th day of this instant June, as a day of solemn thanksgiving and praise to God for his goodness and favor, many particulars of which mercy might be instanced, but we doubt not those who are sensible of God's afflictions have been as diligent to espy him returning to us, and that the Lord may behold us as a people offering praise and thereby glorifying him. The council doth commend it to the respective ministers, elders, and people of this jurisdiction, solemnly and seriously, to keep the same beseeching, that being persuaded by the mercies of God, we may all, even this whole people, offer up our bodies and souls as living and acceptable service unto God by Jesus Christ. A couple of things here. Note that the actual first Thanksgiving was proclaimed 56 years after the landing at Plymouth Rock, and so it had nothing to do at all with the Pilgrims. You might also note that it was in June, which actually makes a lot more sense than a cold Massachusetts November. And finally, you might note that the first Thanksgiving was actually to celebrate a white military victory over the Indians in what was called King Philip's War, not to invite them all to sit around the same table over turkey and cranberry sauce. Now, the present third Thursday in November holiday originated as a propaganda stunt proclaimed by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, in order to distract the North's attention from the fact that at the time the Union was getting its ass kicked by the Confederate Army. Getting back to the Pilgrims, though, you know, I ain't bitch and moan because you guys won't come up here to the Northwest and pack your U-Haul trailers and get in your SUVs and come driving up interstate highways and staying in motels at night, coming here to the homeland that the same God that the Pilgrims worshipped has appointed for our destiny here. Or gods, if you prefer. I'm not going to get into that. But I've also cited the times past when our ancestors came west and they packed all of their gear in their wagons and slowly marched across the plains. But let's go back a little bit further to the time of the Pilgrims and think about what it must have been like getting into one of those tiny little wooden wall ships in some harbor in Portsmouth or Plymouth in England and actually having to cross the North Atlantic in a vessel that was the size of a large rowboat today. Have any of you guys ever actually seen a full-scale reproduction of, say, the Mayflower or some of the early ships like Columbus's, Nina, Pinta, Santa Maria, etc., etc.? You take a look at those things and you realize that these ships actually cross the entire Atlantic. It's astounding. The sheer courage and faith and hardihood of our ancestors who came from Europe to settle this land never, ever ceases to amaze me. You look at what our ancestors did, and you look at us today, and you just wonder, what in God's name happened to us? How is it that we can become so pusillanimous, so degraded, as to allow what has happened to this country to occur? We can give back to our ancestors who made that voyage in those leaky, tiny little ships, and our ancestors who marched across the plain in those Conestoga wagons. We can give back to them some measure of the heritage and the debt that we owe them by doing right in this time today. All of you out there know what's right, or else you wouldn't be listening to this. The time has come for you to do what is right. The time has come for you to honor the men and women who sailed across the North Atlantic in those tiny ships and who marched across this continent in the wake of those Conestoga wagons by following in their spiritual footsteps and by taking yourself and your family and your hopes, your dreams, and your destiny into a new land where once more our people can be free. Let me go ahead and wish a happy Thanksgiving to all of you, and we'll see you next week. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.